Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM Sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Like most summer evenings in the southern city of Natchez, Mississippi, it was hot and steamy on that Thursday night. A 68-year-old Jane Sergeant Merrill was waiting in her home known as Glen Burnie for her cousin, Duncan Miner, to arrive. Known by locals as Miss Jenny, she was regarded as an eccentric old lady to those in town, living as a recluse, rarely leaving her house. One of the only guests allowed to pass through her front gate was Duncan, who was also 68, and he saddled his horse every night at his nearby home, Oakland, and rode the short distance to see Jenny, the only woman he'd ever loved. He returned home each morning, just before dawn. It was a nightly ritual that was decades old, but on that night in August 1932, it was going to come to a sudden and shocking end. On his ride to Glen Burnie, two local African-American men, Willie Boyd and M.C. Hatcher, waved Duncan down. Willie told him he was on his way to church and heard what sounded like screaming and gunshots coming from Glen Burnie. He feared that Miss Jenny might be in trouble. Alarmed, Duncan spurred his horse into a gallop and arrived at the house that was dark and silent. He called out for Jenny, but there was no reply. He quickly found a lantern, and when he lifted the light, he discovered her house had been ransacked. Furniture was knocked over, things had been thrown about. There were obvious signs of a struggle, and there was also blood spattered on the walls. But there was no sign of Jenny. One of the men who worked on Jenny's farm ran to a nearby store to telephone the sheriff, and within minutes after the arrival of the deputies, Duncan's worst fears were confirmed. Jenny had been murdered. And within days, it was a crime that would make headlines across the country. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to season 8, Home, which is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and produced and co-hosted by Cody Back. With all our episodes this season, we're taking you along for the ride as we go in search of America's murder houses, where the spirits of crimes gone by still linger. We're going behind the locked doors of both famous and little-known places where murder, violence, and bloody events continue to echo today as a haunting. In this episode, we'll be taking you to Natchez, Mississippi, in the hot and humid summer of 1932, when what should have been a tragic but still ordinary murder captured the imagination of America during the Great Depression. It was a story of wealth, poverty, tragedy, death, and ghosts, and while mostly forgotten today, it created a sensation at the time. So give this one a listen, and I hope you'll take a bit of advice. I love goats as much as the next guy, but be sure not to keep them in your house if you don't want to end up in the newspapers or in an asylum. The story of Goat Castle, which spread after the murder of Jenny Merrill, began in 1932, but in truth, it started decades before. Even so, the murder brought hundreds of people to Natchez, no matter how hard it was to get there at the time. There were no airports, the main highway was a dirt road, and there were no bridges that offered a direct route until 1940, only ferry boats. But people came anyway, crossing the Mississippi, driving the treacherous roads, and traveling by train to a remote and isolated town to experience what seemed to them to be a living, breathing, authentic example of the Old South. Why people use their savings and pinch their pennies to make the trip to Natchez has a lot to do with its history, a history that made the town a very unique place. It was the oldest settlement on the lower half of the Mississippi River and earned its name from its original inhabitants, the Natchez Nation. It was settled by the French, the English, the Spanish, the French again, and finally by Americans in 1798. The town had its fair share of visitors over the years, even before the Civil War. When it was the capital of the Mississippi Territory, former Vice President Aaron Burr, you know, the bad guy from Hamilton, was arrested here for conspiring to start his own country. Naturalist John James Audubon spent a couple of months in town painting birds. P.T. Barnum brought the Swedish singing sensation Jenny Lind to Natchez in 1851, where she performed for a sold-out crowd, the same as she did in every other city. Down below the river bluffs was an area known as Natchez Under the Hill, which had a reputation completely opposite of the fine homes and finer citizens who lived up top. It was one of the most notorious river landings on the Mississippi, filled to the gills with gamblers, thieves, cutthroats, river pirates, swindlers, and prostitutes. Those who worked on the river, loading cotton and unloading slaves, frequented its saloons, and murders by knife and by gun were a regular feature of life under the hill. But it was really the wealth and mansions above the bluff that defined Natchez. It was a southern city, but it was largely settled by northerners from Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Maryland, and Massachusetts. They came to claim their share of the region's cotton boom, building stately homes, creating large estates, and ignoring whatever distaste they'd had back home about keeping enslaved people around to do all the work. As the market for cotton increased, so did the numbers of slaves in Natchez, along with the vast amounts of money the plantation owners were making. When the Civil War began, the world that Natchez planters enjoyed came to a swift end. Union troops arrived in 1863 after having seized Vicksburg, another town on the bluffs further upriver. The loyalties of plantation owners in Natchez were divided between the Union and the Confederacy, but regardless of their sympathies, the Yankees seized control of most of their estates. While officers used the mansions for headquarters, the soldiers pitched tents on the ground around them. Those loyal to the Union who entertained the troops in Natchez were the most fortunate after the smoke cleared. Many of them hung on to their land and, in most cases, their money. Those who weren't loyal were plunged into poverty when the Confederacy collapsed at the end of the war. The enslaved people were set free and abandoned the plantations. Cotton prices collapsed and people starved. The glory days of the Southern aristocracy were over. By the dawn of the 20th century, very little had changed. There wasn't much in the way of new industry. The town was accessible by train, but there were no good roads. Steamboats had become outdated, and Natchez was left to sit on the sidelines of modern life for years. Still, the magnificent homes and the estates built from the wealth the city had once known remained. Aside from being weather-beaten and needing repairs, not much had changed in a century for most of those old structures. Some of the descendants of the original family still lived in them, trying to keep the bills paid and the lights on. In the 1930s, Americans were fascinated by the Old South. The movies, still in their early days, had created a nostalgia for the plantation South that was completely detached from reality, even though most people didn't know that. Hollywood brought Southern romance to life in films where the plantation setting was the main attraction. You know, the white column mansions, the ladies in hoop skirts, and the black house slaves who were all too happy to serve their white masters. It was a well-established image even before the publication of Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind. In fact, in 1930, a book by Stark Young called So Red the Rose became a bestseller about the Old South. The book was set in Natchez. Natchez had all the Southern romance and drama that anyone could want, but this was no movie set. It was real. There was no other city in the South that could boast as many surviving plantation houses as Natchez, and that included Jenny Merrill's home, Glen Burnie. But in 1932, visitors to Natchez were not so interested in the glamorous Southern way of life presented by the local garden club. They didn't even care so much about Glen Burnie, where Miss Jenny's murder occurred. They were curious about the other house. They wanted to see the one with the goats. The one where the wild man and the goat woman lived. The one where the stories of William Faulkner came to life. Jenny Merrill's life should have turned out differently. She grew up with every advantage, receiving not only an elite education, but the social skills of a woman who spent her childhood being prepared for marriage into privileged society. She was expected to have children to preserve family bloodlines as well as the family's fortune. But the Civil War would complicate that for Jenny and every other young Natchez woman just like her. Jenny's full name, Jane Sergeant Merrill, signaled her elite status thanks to the fact that the Sergeant and Merrill families were among the wealthiest in the antebellum South. She had been born in 1863, and her family managed to hold on to most of their money because her father, Ayres P. Merrill Jr., was a friend and staunch supporter of General Ulysses S. Grant. Not only was Merrill allowed to harvest his cotton that season after the Union came to town, but Grant also allowed him to take his family north to New York City, where they waited out the war in a home on Washington Square. While there, Ayres formed a partnership with a cousin, Walter Goodman, and after the war, he reclaimed the fortune he'd lost in slave labor and cotton by selling Southern land and farm machinery. Later, when Grant became president, he appointed Merrill to the position of minister to Belgium. Jenny accompanied her father to Europe and mingled with aristocrats and royalty, including Queen Victoria. When Jenny's father suffered a stroke, he resigned his position and the family returned to America. Ayres Merrill died in New Jersey in 1883. Jenny, now a wealthy young woman on her own, traveled and lived in various cities, including New Orleans, Louisville, Memphis, Baltimore, and New York, before returning to Natchez to stay. During her decades away, she became a social reformer who worked to improve the living conditions of immigrant mothers, documented the plight of the poor, and went on several speaking tours, raising money to help immigrant children's social programs and settlement houses. While she'd had her share of men who were interested in her, she chose to live independently, to travel, and to pursue a life of public service during the years that most women of the era were considering marriage. However, as the 19th century came to an end, Jenny, now in her mid-30s, returned to Natchez to live the rest of her life in peace and quiet, or so she believed at the time. Had it not been for the war, Jenny would have grown up with the expectation of marrying a man who could secure the family's wealth and property. This usually meant marrying a son, probably a cousin, from one of the elite families in Natchez. But things didn't work out that way, although one of her cousins, Walter Goodman, the son of the Walter Goodman her father had partnered with, fell madly in love with her soon after her father's death. Though only Walter's letters survive, they reveal a young man who was smitten with Jenny. Her feelings about him are unknown, but since his name isn't going to come up again in our story, we can assume they weren't reciprocated. Besides that, Jenny had never forgotten about another cousin, Duncan Minor, whom she'd known her entire life. Their mothers had been first cousins, and like Jenny, he was part of the Sergeant family, the richest in the region. Duncan and Jenny had both been born in 1863, the same year that Union troops began occupying Natchez. Yet unlike the Merrills, who went north to wait out the war, John and Kate Minor stayed. Much to the unhappiness of their Confederate-loving neighbors, the Miners were fiercely loyal to the Union, and their home, Oakland, became a gathering place for federal officers until late 1864, when they received a pass to also stay in New York until the war ended. After they returned home, John suffered the most from the loss of friends and neighbors caused by his loyalty to the Union. His health became poor, and in 1869, while on a trip, he sustained a head injury at a hotel and died. Kate carried on the family business, as she always had. She actually brought more wealth to the marriage than John. She inherited several mansions, plantations from relatives over the next few years. Once he was old enough, Duncan was sent north to receive a top-notch education, after which he returned to Natchez and began managing his mother's plantations in Mississippi and Louisiana, most of which he eventually inherited. And there he waited, still in love with Jenny Merrill, until she finally came home in the late 1890s. After renting a few other houses, Jenny purchased Glen Burnie in 1904. It had been built years before in 1833 and sat on several acres of land just across the road from where she was born. This undoubtedly pleased Duncan. He still lived with his mother. And it was about this time when he began the evening ritual of saddling his horse and riding to see Jenny at Glen Burnie. He'd waited 20 years to be with her, an extraordinary amount of time for anyone to remain in love with someone. But Duncan was a bit on the eccentric side, as Jenny would also prove to be. In addition to becoming a virtual recluse at Glen Burnie, she continued to wear fashions of the 1890s purchased when she lived in New York until the day she died. Most of her interactions with people were with Duncan and the men and women she hired to cook for and maintain her property. When she had to go into town, she eventually purchased a Model T Roadster for basic errands, running through stoplights and stop signs as she went. Every policeman in Natchez knew she never waited for a red light, but none of them ever gave her a ticket. She continued to live her quiet and peaceful life until early 1916, when she acquired some new neighbors on the adjacent property called Glenwood. Little did she know that their arrival next door would mark the beginning of a relentless, many-year feud that would not only disrupt the solitude that she craved, but would very likely result in her murder. If your relatives were a guarantee of your success, then Richard Henry Clay Dana, better known as Dick, should have been a man to be reckoned with. The Danas had been a household name in America for a century. Richard Henry Dana was an attorney and the author of the popular book 2 Years Before the Mast. There was also Charles Dana Gibson, the artist who created the famous Gibson Girl. Look it up if you don't know what that is. There was also Charles Anderson Dana, Abraham Lincoln's assistant secretary of war, who later became editor and owner of the New York Sun, where Dick's brother also worked. Many of Dick's ancestors were ministers, including his father, Charles, who was the rector of the most famous Episcopal church in the country, Christ Church in Alexandria, Virginia. It was the church that George Washington had attended, but when Charles was there, it was also the church of another important Virginia family, the Lees. And that included Robert E. Lee and his family, with whom Charles became friends. Charles, who didn't really look like the life of a party when you see his humorless, frowning portraits, didn't get married until he was 54, and when he did, it was to a woman half his age, Elvira Close, a parishioner at his church. They were married in 1860, and 6 months later, were on their way to Mississippi. It was probably not a coincidence, although why he left Christ Church after being there for 30 years is a mystery, but I'm guessing maybe his marriage to a woman half his age wasn't super popular with the congregation. Regardless, he started over in Port Gibson, Mississippi, with a church much smaller than the one he'd left behind, and now a young wife who was pregnant with their first son, Charles. The family remained in Port Gibson during the Civil War, which was also occupied by Union troops and was, according to General Grant, quote, a town too pretty to burn. I'm sure the occupants appreciated that. In 1866, the family moved to Natchez, and Charles began his time as rector of the Trinity Episcopal Church, a building and a congregation that had suffered during the war. His fortunes wouldn't improve until a few years later, when he moved to a larger church with a better salary. At that time, he purchased a large home called Glenwood, a wood frame house that had been built in 1841. It had 2 stories, 4 chimneys, a large front veranda, and a balcony that spanned the entire front of the building. In 1871, while living at Glenwood, Dick was born. By now, his father was 65, and he barely had time to enjoy his new house and get to know his infant son before he died in 1873. Elvira was now a young widow with two young sons, and she and her boys stayed on at Oakwood until her death in February 1866 when she was only 53. Dick was now an orphan who never really knew his father, and by the time of his mother's death, his brother Charles had already moved to New York to become a reporter. Tragically, Charles wouldn't live long. He enjoyed several years of the newspaper's heyday, but then joined the army after the United States declared war on Spain in 1898, following the sinking of the battleship Maine in the harbor at Havana, Cuba. He signed up for a 3-year enlistment, but his service ended after only 3 months. He died in Puerto Rico, not in battle, but from disease. He was only 36, never married, and had no children. Glenwood, the family home in Natchez, now belongs solely to Dick. After his mother died, Dick enrolled at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. He was there for 2 years. He'd always shown great musical talent and dreamed of becoming a concert pianist, a dream that ended abruptly after an accident. A window sash fell on his right hand, breaking his fingers and leaving his hand deformed. His dream shattered, he returned to Natchez, but not to his family home in Glenwood. Instead, he boarded at the home of a local musician, Duncan Baker, and his family on Pearl Street. In 1906, he moved again and began boarding at the home of Richard Foreman and his wife, Nydia. Among those who also lived there was Foreman's daughter, Sadie, a lumber company bookkeeper, and Nydia's unmarried sister, Octavia Dockery. Dick's move would be a twist of fate that would change Natchez history forever. Octavia was not a native to Natchez, a fact that would have given Jenny Merrill all the reason she needed to dismiss her socially. She was from a very rural town called Lamartine in Arkansas. She'd been born there in 1866. Her family had moved to the region in the 1850s, migrating west to take advantage of the antebellum cotton boom. Her grandfather, John, became one of the largest land and slave owners in the area. And when he died, his wife, Anne, and their son, Thomas, assumed management of the plantations. They were very successful, but families like theirs, who hadn't invested in anything other than slaves and land, had the most to lose, and did, during the war. Thomas Dockery became an officer in the Confederate Army. He eventually ascended to the rank of general, commanding 2 different Arkansas regiments before being captured during the Siege of Vicksburg. He was paroled after taking an oath of loyalty to the U.S. government, but his loyalty was not worth the paper on which it was signed, and he continued to lead troops in Arkansas until the Confederacy surrendered in the spring of 1865. During this time, he'd also gotten married, and he and his wife Laura had welcomed a daughter named Nydia. After the Confederacy's crushing defeat, he limped home, and he and Laura soon welcomed another daughter, Octavia, and Thomas turned to civil engineering to try and rebuild his fortune. But he failed at establishing a railroad between Little Rock and Shreveport, and then he failed again when he made a failed bid to be the Arkansas Secretary of State. So a few years later, he left Arkansas and moved to Texas, where he found work with the city of Houston. But when he left for Texas, he didn't take his family with him. He sent them to live with a relative, Thomas Mask, who supported his nephew's wife and 2 daughters until Laura died in 1880. After that, Thomas moved to New York and took Nydia and Octavia with him. Nydia was in her early 20s by this time, and Octavia was a teenager. Octavia attended the fashionable Comstock School for young ladies, and both she and her sister would likely have enjoyed the city's social scene if they hadn't been saddened by their father's personal decline. The former Confederate general didn't fare well in New York. Only a few months after Laura's death, he married a young woman from Denmark named Frederica Toole. Just 2 months later, the marriage and Thomas's life started falling apart. Over the course of just a handful of days, newspapers printed frantic reports of public outbursts with headlines like, "General Dockery on the warpath after thrashing 2 men, he thirsts for more blood." Yeah, his life seemed to be unraveling. Well, the following day, Thomas was arrested for abandoning his wife. She'd filed a complaint about him and then, in fear for her life, went to live with a couple she'd worked for. When he was released, he was ordered to pay Frederica $10 a week. Thomas went to live with his daughters at the Buckingham Hotel. This financial situation was now so dire that the hotel held Nydia and Octavia's luggage for the $200 debt that their father owed. All Thomas had left was his reputation as a Confederate general, and occasionally it paid off. I mean, this was a different time. When President Grant died in August 1885, a group of former Confederates living in New York selected Thomas and others to represent Southern soldiers in a military parade in Grant's honor. This prompted several newspaper articles about Thomas's meeting with Grant when he was captured at Vicksburg. Conveniently, though, the stories left out the part where he signed a loyalty oath and then went back to the Confederate Army. Even so, Dixie nostalgia didn't pay the bills, and Thomas was unable to care for his daughters. The sisters remained in New York for a few more years and then left after Nydia's marriage to Richard Foreman, a Mississippi man who was already widowed and had adult children. At 55, he was the same age as Nydia's father, who wasn't thrilled with the match, but beggars can't be choosers, and so he gave his consent to let Foreman marry her. Thomas continued living in New York until his death in February 1898. He died penniless in a boarding house at the age of 65. He was buried in Natchez, a city in which he'd never lived, but where his daughters could pay their respects. Nydia wed the much older Richard Foreman in January 1888, and Octavia was welcomed into the home of her newlywed sister. They finally moved to Natchez in 1896, a city that would turn out to suit Octavia very well. The slim and lovely redhead was what was then called a new woman, a term used in the late 19th century to describe women who were educated, more carefree than their mothers, and dreamed of a career before marriage. Octavia fancied herself a writer, and for a time, the only attention she craved was from publishers. Several potential suitors found this out the hard way when they discovered Octavia had no interest in them. Why she never married is unclear, but her determination to be a published author, well, that never went away. And she did have some success in regional literary magazines, as well as in the Saturday Evening Post. Octavia chased her dreams only to discover, as the 19th century became the 20th, her chances at marriage had faded. She was now 33, although claimed she was 27, and we've got to wonder if Richard Foreman looked back at his promise to Octavia's father that she would always have a home until she married and was surprised she was still in his house 22 years later. At some point in the early 1900s, the Foremans moved to a house on Main Street in Natchez and started taking in boarders. One of them was 37-year-old Dick Dana, and it was at this time that the two of them began a peculiar relationship that lasted for the rest of their lives. After discovering the Foremans had money troubles, Dick came up with an idea. He welcomed the entire family to move to the home he'd inherited from his mother, Glenwood, at no cost, as long as Richard paid the taxes that were owed on the place for the past year. And so Richard, Nydia, Sadie, Octavia, and Dick moved to the old house on the edge of town. The years had not been kind to Glenwood. Weathered clapboards, cracked plaster, and signs of decay had taken their toll, but it was free and, well, impossible to pass up. Within months of moving to the house, though, tragedy struck. Nydia, with whom Octavia had lived her entire life, died from cancer in February 1911. She was only 51. A year later, Nydia's husband, Richard, also died. Sadie, an adult living on her own, was already renting a house in Natchez. Octavia and Dick, two people with no significant means of income and no one to support them, were left to fend for themselves. It had been clear to Octavia for several years that Dick was unable to take care of himself, personally or financially. His behavior had become increasingly erratic over time and was often obsessed with the idea that someone was watching and following him. He'd never had a job, but he did have a little income that came in from Glenwood. People rented land from him on which to raise livestock and paid him for wood cut from the forest, but the money was barely enough to live on. Octavia, now 47, was well past marriage age and had never earned any money other than small payments for magazines. It was time for her to face reality, but it's likely she had no idea about what was going to happen next. Dick and Octavia would never have been able to return to Glenwood if Duncan Miner had his way. When Dick had failed to pay the property taxes on the estate for 1911, Duncan had been the highest bidder and acquired all 45 acres of the property for only $46. Yet just a few years later, likely at the behest of Octavia, a local attorney sent Duncan a letter and asked him to return the property to Dick because he had no place to live. Duncan didn't care. Owning the estate offered both him and Jenny privacy because Glenwood sat adjacent not only to Glen Burnie, but also to land that he owned. As far as he was concerned, the case was closed. What Duncan didn't anticipate, though, was Octavia Dockery. Though she wasn't married to Dick, she came to his defense by filing a bill of complaint in January 1916 that would force Duncan to reconvey the property back to Dick, who was unfit to look after his own interests. Because of his mental state, she asserted the tax deed was null and void because, legally speaking, a person who was mentally incompetent could not be deprived of his inheritance because of tax debts. Duncan's attorneys alleged that when he purchased the property for taxes, Dick was sane and of sound mind and still was. But during what was called the lunacy hearing that took place in February 1917, a jury declared that Dick was non-compos mentis and appointed Octavia as his guardian. Now the pair had the rights to Glenwood, and they couldn't be taken away, or so Octavia thought. She planted a small garden and raised chickens to sell their eggs. She also acquired some hogs and goats that ambled through the forest and were often difficult to find. They made themselves comfortable on the neighbor's property, who sometimes shot at them and mostly reported the trespassing to the sheriff and claimed damages. Octavia had never met Jenny Merrill at this point, but she resented her anyway. And believe me when I tell you, Jenny felt exactly the same way about her. Glen Burnie was half the size of her neighbor's estate. It included the house, two ponds, and some outbuildings. The only livestock she owned was one milk cow. The land around her home was planted with bushes and flowers, and she was particularly fond of a kind of clover that flowered and grew well in the humid climate of Natchez. Unfortunately, her neighbor's hogs also enjoyed the clover and often wandered over to graze. From the time the pair moved in next door, Jenny had a hog problem and an enemy in Octavia Dockery. During the years they lived next door to one another, Jenny filed several lawsuits against Octavia for the damage caused to her corn patch, her ponds, and, of course, to her clover. Every time it happened, she phoned the sheriff's office, and Sheriff Mike Ryan was later said that he made so many trips to her house, he was unable to count them. After each hog invasion, Jenny wrote a nasty note to Octavia and sent one of the men who worked for her to deliver it. Once she demanded payment for keeping the hogs fed and watered. Another time, she had the hogs wrangled and sold. Well, Octavia generally paid the fees, but she filed complaints of her own. After a year of this, Jenny filed another lawsuit and again, angry about the damage done to her property, contacted the sheriff's office. As he'd done many times before, Sheriff Ryan drove out to Glenwood, but this time he issued a writ of seizure for the hogs. He thought this was a simple solution to a dispute between two neighbors, but neither of these women were simple. In fact, the case eventually made its way all the way to the Mississippi Supreme Court. The attorneys on both sides had their hands full with Jenny and Octavia. Jenny's responses to questions were sharp and impatient, probably because she filed so many complaints and nothing had been done. Octavia's replies were cagey and slick, skirting the facts to elicit sympathy for herself and Dick with the jury. She was often selectively unable to recall certain conversations and events and revealed a dry sense of humor when the opposing counsel accused her of training her hogs to cause damage at Jenny's house. She said she couldn't train a hog to do anything but eat, and if she could, well, she'd be rich too. The implication about money wasn't lost on the jurors. And when her own attorney questioned her about how she made a living, she made sure that she distinguished herself from her wealthy neighbor, Jenny, by explaining she had to sell the produce, milk, and eggs that came from her farm to survive. This was a response that those on the jury who hadn't been born with money could understand. And it got worse for Jenny from there. When the Justice of the Peace testified about accompanying the sheriff to her property to inspect the alleged damages, he said that he not only didn't see any damage, but that he couldn't recall any individual visits to Glen Burnie because he'd had to go out there so many times he couldn't keep track of them. Jenny's lawsuit was unsuccessful, and in the years to come, Octavia's hogs continued to trespass on Jenny's property while Octavia's own home with Dick fell slowly and surely into ruin. There was no question that Jenny Merrill had become increasingly odd over the years. Her desire for isolation had continued, even worsened. Her doors closed to everyone but Duncan. Each evening at dusk, he rode to Glen Burnie and stayed with Jenny until dawn. No one knows why the couple never married. Some believe they'd done so in secret, but no record of it was ever found. In time, Duncan began to share Jenny's eccentricities. He became withdrawn as he grew older, speaking to no one, apparently satisfied with the life that Jenny had chosen for him. Dick had only become stranger as the years had gone by. He fell into states of depression that lasted for days at a time. His hair and beard grew long and tangled, and he wandered the woods for hours. The accident that had ended Dick's dream of becoming a concert pianist had left him unable to play without missing certain notes, but this didn't stop him. He often sat at the piano until late at night, tinkling endlessly with melancholy melodies that never sounded quite right. Despite the fact that Dick had made a promise to Nydia on her deathbed that he would always take care of her sister, the truth of the matter was that Octavia looked after him. She did so partly because she felt genuine love for a man who had lost his grip on reality, and also because her own situation had been so precarious after the deaths of Nydia and Richard. Octavia fought valiantly against any attempt that was made to evict herself and Dick from Glenwood. She countered every court order by finding loopholes in the law and later by using the local press to garner sympathy from the community. And she had no choice, not really, because eviction would have been even worse than what Glenwood had become. As early as 1917, Glenwood had been described as dilapidated. The house had no electricity and no running water. The furniture that Dick's parents had owned was still there, as were all the books in his father's once huge library. But the roof was rotten and leaked, and year by year, the house crumbled further into disrepair. Outside, chimneys crumbled. The second-story balcony had become unstable. Windows were broken, and the front porch was rotting away. Inside, the wallpaper was peeling off, ceiling plaster was falling, and dust and cobwebs covered everything. Octavia slept in an upstairs bedroom on a mildewed mattress that was perched between two chairs, even though it was only feet away from an impressive four-poster mahogany bed. Over the years, the herd of goats that had been purchased for their milk took up residence in the house. They were joined by cats, chickens, and geese. Birds nested in chairs and on furniture from which the upholstery had not already been stripped and eaten by the goats. The goats had also chewed the wallpaper as far up as they could stretch their necks and ate pages from the books that had been pulled off the shelves where chickens had built their nests. Curtains and drapes hung from the windows in shreds, water-stained and ruined, and Dick's piano was one of the few things not touched by the devastation. Much has been made of Dick's mental instability, but it seems as if it was almost contagious. Since Octavia, too, seemed resigned to live in the filth that had just become worse as the years went by. She spent much of her time trying to defend the property from tax liens, but frequently failed. Glenwood was sold for debts owed several times while they lived there, but each time Octavia convinced the owners to allow them to stay. Rents went unpaid, eviction notices were issued, but through it all, she managed to hold on to the property by issuing her own bills of complaint and reminding the court that Glenwood was Dick's inheritance and couldn't be taken away from a man who was clearly insane. And if there had been any questions about Dick's mental status, there weren't any longer. He spent his days wandering the woods and climbing trees, disappearing into the branches until Octavia called to him to come inside after dark. It's also possible he was sometimes abusive to her, although it was unlikely he knew what he was doing. In early 1931, people who lived nearby found her unconscious in their field. When deputies were called, Octavia claimed it was a passing stranger that had hurt her, but neighbors were convinced that it had been Dick that had beaten her. Dick Dana was now the human equivalent of what Glenwood had become. Time passed, and the two houses, Glenwood and Glen Burnie, continued to stand near and yet far away from one another. The occupants never spoke. Their only communication was in the pithy notes sent to Octavia when her hogs were discovered rooting around in Jenny's clover. Calls to the sheriff followed, as did visits from sheriff's deputies who came to confiscate the roaming animals. Then Octavia started returning the favor by contacting the sheriff with her own complaints and lawsuits that forced Jenny to return livestock she kept as payment for alleged damages. Glenwood was all Octavia had, and she would do anything to defend it against a woman who looked down on her and who'd known nothing but wealth and privilege throughout her life. Octavia scratched out a living at Glenwood, trying to care for Dick and trying to find loopholes to prevent their eviction. But Jenny was relentless. Her complaints to the sheriff never seemed to end, and lawsuits claiming damage by trespassing animals were a constant source of irritation. By 1932, during the worst of the Depression, Octavia had reached her limit. Enough was enough, she thought. And then on August 4th, when Duncan arrived at Glen Burnie after being warned to screams and gunshots, he discovered that something terrible had happened at Jenny's home. The front room had been destroyed. Broken glass and overturned furniture covered the floors. Blood was spattered on the walls, and a wet trail of gore led out of the house into the driveway. Duncan frantically searched the house and grounds, but found no trace of Jenny. When the sheriff arrived, his men spent the night combing the woods surrounding the property, and near dawn, one of them discovered Jenny's body, hidden behind some bushes. She was barefoot and wore a blood-soaked blue dress. She had been shot in the chest and the head by a .32 caliber revolver. Not surprisingly, the authorities immediately suspected Dick and Octavia had played a role in the murder. Between Dick's mental instability and the long history of problems between Octavia and Jenny, it seemed obvious they had committed the murder. Both were arrested and charged, even though the police had no evidence to link them to the crime. Newspapers all over the country picked up the story. But what drew America's attention to Natchez for the next few weeks wasn't the mystery of who killed Jenny Merrill, but the two people suspected of her murder. Their personal stories and the life they'd led on their rundown estate was so shocking that the other principals in the case were nearly forgotten. Readers were stunned by the first real glimpse into the conditions at Glenwood. Numerous photographs portrayed the poverty of the plantation's inhabitants and revealed a once grand home that had been turned into a ramshackle barn where farm animals freely roamed. Reporters nicknamed the place Goat Castle and its stock. The mansion was in shambles. A column that once supported the veranda across the front of the house had collapsed, and now the ceiling sagged dramatically. Broken windows looked out at the lawn like blackened eyes, and holes dotted the porch where the wood had rotted through. Chickens and geese nestled in what had once been expensive velvet and rosewood furniture. The upholstery was alive with fleas and mites, while cockroaches and water bugs skittered across the floor. Animal droppings were spotted on the once beautiful hardwood, which was also strewn with magazines and newspapers. $1,000. On one table lay a faded Confederate uniform, which had likely belonged to Octavia's father. And always present were the home's new namesake, the goats. The animals wandered freely, shuffling in and out of rooms, oblivious to visitors, munching carelessly on books and curtains. Some of the herd could be spotted on the second-story balcony, peering down at those who entered the house. And yes, soon there were many who entered the house. See, horrified and fascinated tourists and curiosity seekers flocked to Natchez. While Dick and Octavia were still in jail, souvenir hunters picked through the rubbish at Glenwood and carried off relics and antiques. Octavia gave many interviews from her jail cell, gaining sympathy from readers as she spoke about their poverty and the years she'd spent caring for Dick. Locals not only stopped by the jail to leave her flowers and kind words, but also soon began to demand that she and Dick be released. Eventually, the two were allowed to return home on their own recognizance. The police had failed to gather any evidence that could be used to convict them, and the prosecutor knew an unbiased jury to hear any case against them would probably never be found. And soon, any hopes of a case against them were dashed when the police chief of Pine Bluff, Arkansas, notified the authorities in Natchez about an African-American man who had been shot to death in his town. George Pearls had been killed after pulling a .32 caliber revolver on a Pine Bluff policeman. Papers found on Pearls' body indicated that he'd recently been to Natchez. As Jenny Merrill had been killed with a pistol of the same caliber, the chief offered an examination of the weapon. Papers found in Pearls' pockets led detectives to a woman named Emily Burns, who owned a boarding house in Natchez. After being questioned, she admitted that she and Pearls had attempted to rob Glen Burnie. They were confronted there by Jenny, who attempted to take the gun away from Pearls. In the struggle, Jenny was shot. A ballistics test confirmed most of the story, or at least the part that Jenny had been killed by the gun found on Pearls. But was there more to this story than meets the eye? There were many who questioned the veracity of Emily Burns' confession and still wondered what role the residents of Glenwood had played in Jenny's death. A black man and woman seemed convenient scapegoats for murder in the Jim Crow South of 1932. Some of those who wondered about Emily's case must have been in positions of authority, because in 1940, with little fanfare, Mississippi's governor pardoned Emily Burns for her role in the murder, leaving only a dead man as the only person ever held responsible for the murder of Jenny Merrill. As for Dick and Octavia, they achieved fame overnight. Octavia got Dick cleaned up, shaved, and dressed in a new suit. As more and more people arrived from around the country to see Goat Castle, Octavia, like a barker at a carnival sideshow, began conducting tours of the house and property, charging 50 cents a person. Octavia walked around the house carrying a goat in her arms, spinning tales of the plantation's heyday, while Dick provided musical accompaniment for the tours, playing off-kilter tunes on his piano. It seemed obvious to everyone who came that the former magnificence of the Southern Mansion had been lost to filth and ankle-deep debris. Octavia cooked in the library fireplace, where kettles and pans rested on a once ornate carved table. The floor was covered with straw, burlap bags, old shoes, and cans. The mirror above the hearth was blackened with age, and the marble mantel now held an odd assortment of items that included burned matches, empty tobacco pouches, a pipe, an old calendar, and a bust of Charles Dickens. The library had long ago stopped being used for its intended purpose. Over the course of its decline, the books that had belonged to Dick's father had been shoved back on their shelves to make room for lard buckets, coffee cans, and cooking pots. Books written in Latin and Greek now held cans of nails. Octavia cooked upstairs, too. In what had been another bedroom, she had taken the springs from one of the four-poster beds and had used them to smoke goat meat. In the same room were trunks of books, Reverend Dana's sermons, letters, and antique clothing. On the lid of one of these trunks, a reporter wrote, quote, "were five wasps' nests, the occupants of which buzz dangerously around your head when you approach." William Faulkner had written about the decline and degradation of the South, but this was no imaginary place from one of his books. Americans were captivated by the spectacle of the dilapidated Annabella mansion teeming with animals, the strange behavior of its occupants, and the social decline of a once respected Southern family. And they came to the conclusion that Faulkner had been telling the truth. The tours of the old house continued for years, drawing less money as time went on, but still enough to sustain Octavia and Dick for another 16 years. At the time when the murder of Jenny Merrill was still in the news, the wild man and the goat woman, as they were called in press reports, drew huge crowds to the house and even took their show on the road. They appeared to capacity crowds in various towns around the area where Dick sang and played the piano, and they exhibited relics from Goat Castle. Octavia continued to do all she could to not only keep herself and Dick at Glenwood, a house they didn't actually own, but to also provide enough money for them to live. She tried suing the sheriff's office for wrongful arrest and pain and suffering, but didn't fare well. Things became worse when Charles Zerkowski, who owned the mortgage on Glenwood, died without taking complete ownership and left his heirs with the burden of what to do with the ruined estate and the two well-known squatters who refused to leave. Afraid to do anything about the situation, they allowed Octavia, Dick, and the goats to remain for years. From time to time, one of the heirs went to the farm and tried to convince them to leave, but it didn't work. Octavia fought tooth and nail against any attempts to evict them. Eventually, in 1937, Isaac Zerkowski reassured the press he had no intention of throwing them off the land. They stayed for more than another decade while the house literally fell down around them. Duncan Miner, Jenny Merrill's faithful lover, died in 1939. He never believed the authorities about who killed Jenny. He always assumed that Octavia and Dick had something to do with her death. And he was undoubtedly right. Dick Dana eventually became old and frail, and he died on October 10, 1948, at the age of 77. His death was caused by pneumonia and other complications caused by living at Glenwood. He passed away in his sleep in an upstairs bedroom. The Zerkowski family believed they could now assume control of the estate. Because public sympathy had long rested with the eccentric couple, they never forced an eviction, even though they could have. They paid the property taxes every year with no hope of ever recovering the money. But now, with Dick gone, they thought they could move forward. But they were wrong. At 83 and in failing health in the months following Dick's death, Octavia had one more card to play. In February 1949, she filed a bill of complaint asserting that she now owned the estate because she was Dick's wife. They had been married back in 1902, she claimed. The Zerkowskis answered her complaint with one of their own, stating that her story was, quote, wholly fictitious, false, and pretended. Which, of course, it was. But only a few weeks after filing her lawsuit, Octavia died. The news of her death, like that of Dick Dana, made national news. In June, the children of her father's brother filed a claim to her personal belongings and came to Natchez, where they held an auction at Glenwood. The Zerkowskis immediately sold the estate to a developer, and in 1955, Goat Castle was torn down and replaced by a modern housing development of ranch homes. The new neighborhood was called Glenwood, which would have turned Goat Castle into a forgotten story of Natchez, if not for the ghostly tales that followed in its wake. The ghost stories about Goat Castle actually began long before the deaths of Dick and Octavia. While they managed to enjoy the sympathies of most of the locals, there were still plenty of people in Natchez who suspected they were involved in Jenny's murder. So were the ghostly reports merely a bit of creative finger pointing, or were they real? It was said that each day after the last tourist left Goat Castle, Dick would return to his piano and play strange, awkward melodies that grew louder as the night wore on. The nighttime music was so loud and explosive, it could be heard from neighboring farms. One neighbor reported that it was, quote, loud enough to wake the dead. And perhaps it really was, because after nightfall, people in the area began to avoid the thicket of woods between Glenwood and Glen Burnie. Rumors spread they were haunted by the spirit of Jenny Merrill, seeking vengeance for her murder. There were dozens of reports of seeing her walking, barefoot, wearing a blue, blood-stained dress, and passing through the trees, perhaps searching for Octavia's hogs, which had so often destroyed her flowers, or even for Octavia herself, the one many suspected had pulled the trigger of the .32-caliber revolver she kept in her purse. Sometimes Jenny's moans, wails, and weeping were heard over the sounds of Dick's piano, which he played louder and louder as he attempted to drown out the mournful cries of the dead woman. After Dick and Octavia died, the stories of the haunted woods intensified for a time. The now abandoned Glenwood fell into even greater decay, and those who trespassed there claimed to see the ghost of Octavia wandering around the place, as she often did, searching for Dick. She was usually described as wearing a tattered calico dress and a straw hat, and her face was lined with worry in the passing years. At other times, though, people claimed to see her as young and pretty as she'd once been, wearing a fine dress that her father had bought for her in New York before he began his financial decline. The sightings of Octavia were sometimes followed by the strains of piano music, clumsy tunes with notes that sounded as though they were missed by a crippled hand. But as time passed, the stories of the ghosts faded, and the legends of Goat Castle were largely forgotten. As new homes were built in the subdivision named for Goat Castle, the forest that once surrounded Glenwood grew smaller, and the bizarre events that once happened there vanished from the memories of those who lived in Natchez. Only the tales of Jenny's spirit persisted for a time. Her former home, Glen Burnie, remained standing as it does today. And one owner who moved into that house in 1978 would sometimes tell stories of hearing a disembodied voice that called out to her repeatedly. She never found anyone in the house. Another time, when a friend was visiting, the guest and her daughter were sitting on the porch. Their small dog was lying at their feet, but then suddenly started barking. As they were getting up to see what was wrong, they heard a voice, again calling the owner's name, but there was no one there. She also recalled a time when a doctor friend and his wife stayed the night at Glen Burnie. The next morning, they announced they were cutting short their stay because they'd been unable to sleep. All through the night, they'd heard footsteps pacing back and forth in the hallway outside their bedroom. They only stopped when they opened the door to see who was there, but there was no one in the hall. On another occasion, a production company used Glen Burnie as a filming location, and the director stayed at the house. On the last day he was there, he admitted that he'd heard footsteps outside his room every night, starting around 1:45 a.m. When he opened his door, though, no one was in the hall. The owner also recalled that when she moved in, she had to have the house rewired because the electric circuits were very old. The electricians fed the wire through the conduit pipes, but when they returned the next day to finish the job, the wire had all been pulled out. When they used portable lights, someone or something always pulled out the plugs. Jenny Merrill was notorious for her disapproval of modern conveniences. During her time at Glen Burnie, she had refused to have electricity installed. Perhaps in death, that disapproval continued from beyond the grave. There's more of our show to come, so please enjoy these informative messages from our sponsors.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM Sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
I'm ready when you are, man.
Okay. Hang on, let me pick that. Okay, I'm ready. Welcome back to American Hauntings, and let me just say thanks to all of you who have returned for our newest episode in our latest season. American Hauntings is created, written, and narrated by Troy Taylor. That's me. And with me is our producer and co-host, stepping up to the plate, batting cleanup, Cody Beck.
I'm batting cleanup now.
Yeah, well, I thought maybe this time.
So. This time, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. I got to clean up the mess you just made.
Well, there's that. There is that. But yeah, that's usually what you do. So is clean up whatever mess we end up with when we're done recording this. So, yeah.
Oh, man. Well, no, I like that you're changing it up a little bit. I like that you're adding little new things to it each time. It's good. What's been going on, dude? We haven't talked for a little while.
Not much. In fact, I got it. It's been so long. I couldn't remember what this episode was about.
Oh yeah.
I had to look and I'm like, oh yeah, Goat Castle. Yeah. I remember now. But yeah, cause I usually do these ahead of time, and yeah, I guess we haven't talked, for a couple of weeks now. So, well, I mean, other than, you know, occasional messages.
Yeah. Asking if you've seen this movie yet or if I've seen that movie yet.
Which I did see, The Coffee Table. I put up a review on Letterboxd. Mm-hmm. Have you seen it yet?
No, I haven't.
All I can say is I don't want to give anything away. So I was very careful about what I put in on Letterboxd too. It is a Spanish film. So, mm-hmm. you know, right there, it could go anywhere.
Right.
This is the most deranged, possibly effed up movie I've ever seen.
No shit.
The whole movie revolves around the idea that one particular choice can change your entire life. Mm-hmm. And in this particular case, it's because this guy buys an ugly coffee table.
Wow.
And I know that doesn't sound like much. I would call it flat out horror. I would call it horror adjacent, definitely disturbing. And there's definitely, at least through the first half, some pretty dark humor, depending on how dark you are. There's some things that I know I shouldn't have been laughing at in this movie, but I did anyway. And let me just say, it is a very strange movie, but it's definitely worth the hour and 22 minutes of watching it, or $5, whatever I paid to rent it. It's worth watching. But listen, it's not going to be for everybody. I mean, read my review on Letterboxd, maybe, and where I kind of throw in a couple of warnings, but I don't want to give too much away, so I won't. So
perfect.
But yeah. In the last 2 weeks, I've seen quite a few movies, some really bad ones, and a couple of pretty good ones too. So
I got
2.5 stars and 4 stars. So I'm running the gamut here. So
I've been playing a little bit of catch up at work. So the last movie I saw Sunday was a screening of the Garfield movie. So so I'm getting them in where I can, but
yeah, I saw a couple of dogs, but we also got to see Strangers Chapter 1, and I give that a big thumbs up.
Really?
I mean, for anybody who thinks it's the exact same thing, it's not exactly the same thing, but hello, it's rebooting the storyline, and there are things in it that are not the same as in the original. And you know, it's a new version. I mean, it's those characters, but it's not like it's a continuation of anything. It's restarting it, and they're going to have 3 whole chapters. So obviously we're going to go beyond what happens in The Strangers. I mean, Pray at Night is almost like a completely different movie.
Yeah. Because
it is completely different. I like it, but it's not, you can't, it's not a direct sequel, not really, because it's sort of like those characters in a different setting. So it's not the same, but this really kind of picks up with the young couple in a house, isolated house, and goes from there. But it's good. It is good. And I did like it a lot. And so I will be excited to see what happens next. I mean, I love the original director, Brian Bertino, also did, you know, The Dark and the Wicked, which, as you know, is one of my all-time favorite films. But then this is Rennie Harlan. So he's done some good movies too. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I liked it. So it went on my top list. I don't know what number that's going to look like. I usually just go with my 4 and 4.5 stars, but believe it or not, I'm finally starting to get some.
Nice.
Because things were slim pickings at the beginning of the year. Not only were there not that many movies, but most of them sucked. Mm-hmm. So things are getting better. They are getting better. So anyway, enough with the movie talk, I'm sure. So we should probably move up to a couple of things we've got coming up and then get started on this episode.
Yeah.
I do want to say this coming week, a couple days after you guys hear this, if you are in Arizona, Nevada, California, in that area, and you happen to think, hey, gee, I should go to Las Vegas for Memorial Day weekend, come see me. I will be at Buffalo Bills Casino in Prim. That is the home of the Bonnie and Clyde Death Car. And on Saturday, May 25th at 3 p.m., open to the public, I'm doing a wild ride with Bonnie and Clyde kind of thing. So it should be fun. The Death Car is there on display. Dutch Schultz's car is there too. Capone owned it for a while. FDR owned it for a while.
Nice.
That's also there. But they're doing some cool stuff this weekend. So, and you know, like I said, I'd love to see anybody who's out in that area who might get a chance to come by. Also on June 1st, I had put together that event I talked about last time, that night behind the museum.
Yeah.
Stories. It's already sold out.
Nice.
So I added one by demand. I added another one on June 28th. So at the end of the month after the conference, I'll be doing it again. It's a presentation. I'm going to be telling the stories of some of my favorite things in the museum. Everybody gets popcorn and a soda as it comes with your ticket. So come see us. I'm also doing a Limp family dinner in June and St. Louis Exorcism dinner in June at the museum. So I'm kind of trying to keep it, you know, stuff I love and not anything too stressful before the conference. But
sure.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, come see us. The museum, all the great feedback we've gotten from the museum has been fantastic. It's been exciting. It has been so much fun and I'm constantly adding new stuff. So anyway, I did mention the conference too. Again, time's running out, guys. We are down to the end now. It is by the time you hear this, it will literally be a month away. Actually,
so weird.
As far as the after hour things, the Thursday night stuff, it is a month away. The first night of the conference will be a month from tomorrow. So if you're planning on coming, now's your chance. Ticket prices are going to go up at the door. So get them while they're still discounted before it's too late. And also don't forget my Without a Trace number 2 book is coming out too.
I saw that.
So I got to talking about that to somebody, and I was talking about missing people and stuff. And I was telling them the story about putting this book together, cause we'd gotten so many stories from our listeners about, you know, stuff. And I said, and then since then I just keep getting more. So I don't know, there may be a Without a Trace 3 at some point in the future, but let's just get number 2 out right now.
Right. Then we'll worry about
And then next week, of course, we'll have a new episode of our Patreon podcast, which is Dead Men Do Tell Tales. That's the Ed Gein Texas Chainsaw Massacre combination podcast that we've got going. That's every other week. You can find out about that through Patreon. Just go to our site at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings and you get signed up for that. It's only, you know, for the bare minimum. If you, let's say you don't want to get anything cool in the mail, you don't want to get any t-shirts, anything like that, it's only $5. You can't even buy, it's so cheap It's so cheap.
How cheap is it, Troy?
It's so cheap that McDonald's is bringing back their $5 value meal because it's such a deal. So just getting that for $5, it's like a ticket to the museum. It's only $5. It's so cheap. You don't want to pass it up. So
anyway, I love it.
Same way with Patreon. So get signed up. Get in on that podcast. I think you'll enjoy it if you like weird, morbid things. And obviously you do. You wouldn't be listening to this podcast. So anyway, I'm exhausted my list now. So I turn it over to you.
Beautiful. Well, as Troy mentioned at the end there, Patreon, you know, I just wanted to give a shout out to our latest subscribers. Yes. So thank you so much for supporting the show. So shout outs to Bill, Nadine, Lazaro, Douglas, Jenny, and Davlin. So thank you so much
see
for
how
supporting
smart all those people are. See,
I know they're making money.
I know.
And we had a listener
discounts
review.
And stuff. Come on, man.
Right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
All good. We had a listener review that I wanted to read real quick. This one is from Logue's mom 82. I'm not sure.
I think it's maybe Logue's mom.
Logue's mom. Sure. Logue's mom. Sounds good.
I hope
Logue's doing well. This review is just titled So Fun. It says, I recently took a quick birthday trip to New Orleans to visit St. Louis Cemetery. When I came back, I was still itching to know more about New Orleans. I found this podcast did an entire season on it. So incredibly knowledgeable and fact-checking, not to mention the countless other seasons they have about spooky haunted places. It's a solid 10 for me. Solid 10. So thank you so much for that review.
And which again reminds me that as soon as I get some free time, I'm going to put together that travel guide thing that I keep saying I'm going to put together with just lists on it for people.
Yes.
Because I've gotten two more requests since our last show. And then I've also had two different people who bought my Haunted New Orleans books because they wanted them to go to take with them on their trip. So anyway, I need to work on that.
It's not just on you. I need to just put a New Orleans page on the site.
I know. I guess put together that list or that travel guide and
put it on the
give
site.
It to you and you could put it on the website. So that would probably be the easier thing. But anyway,
One season we'll get there.
Yeah. one of these days. Yeah.
Well, are you ready to dive in?
Sure.
I didn't know what to expect from the story. Didn't know where the story was
certainly
going.
Not from the title. Yeah.
It was, you know, rich people are weird.
I know. Right. That's all I kept thinking is, you know, that thing and I talked about it when we did the Limp Mansion or the Limp Family, rather, you know, that you always use that F. Scott Fitzgerald quote about the rich are different. They're not like you and me.
Yeah.
And you think, these people are all nuts. And eventually aren't rich anymore, which is just really makes it a Southern tragedy. I think I brought up Faulkner like eight times in this episode because it's right out of a Faulkner story. I mean, it could have been one of his, you know, as insane as some of the things are in this, you know, all the decadence and then the war and everybody losing their money and, you know, and just the crazy eccentric behavior.
Something I was wondering about too is I know that there were especially with Octavia and stuff, you know, a lot of legal proceedings and things like done like that, but is it that old money is just hard to kill? It's hard to die. Like these people always seem to be able to make stuff work or get money. Maybe it's easier to get money back.
Where does it come from? You know, you hear about these people being absolutely broke and don't have a dime to their name, and yet they continue to live well. Okay, not the people at Goat Castle, but you know, over at the other place, you know, they continued to live in the same way that they had always done. Jenny, you know, is crazy, eccentric, you know, does all kinds of nutty things, but yet somehow still manages to hang on to all this money, you know, and Duncan goes off his rocker, which I mean, I kind of get. I mean, they were like together for 40 years, but not because he continued to live with his mom and they just rode over her house every night.
Yeah,
that's crazy, you know. And then the other two were obviously nuts too. But Octavia had lost her money long before, you know, she ever even made it to. I mean, her family was out of money before she even got to Natchez. You know, she was living off her sister and her brother-in-law. So, but yeah, I you know, these it's an interesting group of people.
Yeah, right.
You know, I had first heard about this story, and honestly, I'm not kidding here. I'm pretty sure I had read some kind of Southern ghost story book when I was like 10.
Damn.
And heard about Goat Castle, and it just stuck with me. And I remember a few years later, probably when I was a teenager, I had picked up, you know, I always talk about that book, Haunted Houses, and how, you know, here's a guy driving around, you know, going to haunted places and writing about it. And I, oh, that's what I want to do. You know, he had done a book, I think it was called Houses of Horror. And sure enough, there's Goat Castle. It was actually in a chapter about Natchez, so he didn't give it as much time as that earlier book. And I, boy, for the life of me, can't remember what it was. It was probably like one of those, like, Susie Smith books, which probably wouldn't mean anything to you, but back in the 60s when I was, they were old books when they were in my library, you know what I mean? They've been out for 20 years when I ran across them at the library, and they were, I guess, safe reading for kids because they're pretty low key. And it was probably in, like, you know, Ghosts Around the House or something. One of those kind of, you know, light books that I, that's probably where I saw it first, but I've never quite forgotten it. And when I put together this list, I thought, you know what? It's going to be a really short story, but I want to do Goat Castle.
Yeah.
Well, turned out the story was not so short because the version of it that I had first read about had a lot of mistakes in it. So I ended up having to really rewrite this story and really dig in just a little bit deeper, probably deeper than I needed to. Hopefully I didn't bore anybody with this, but I just thought it was such an interesting story, and the way that everything just fell into ruins.
I mean, it's I don't want to say it's a good story, because it's kind of, because it's just sad, but it's, you know, rich people being rich people. But it's it's, as far as our podcast stuff goes, and like my kind of, you know, outline from your outline, there's not so much to it if you take out just the almost like limp style family tree.
The crazy family stuff, which I put it all in there because it was so interesting to see where they had come from.
Yeah.
I mean, because Dick is nuttier than a fruitcake, but then you look at the people in his family line and they're famous people.
Right.
You know, and so he comes from this really, you know, this renowned family, and yet he becomes known as the wild man of the woods, you know, because he loses his mind. And back in those days, I mean, you know, especially down south, you know, I'm basing this on my reading of William Faulkner. Down in the South, I guess you just kind of let people just do their own thing. You didn't want to step on their toes. So, you know, you just let him wander around in the woods and climb trees, you know, instead of locking him up somewhere for his own safety. And I'm going to say the safety of others.
Yeah.
Although I'm not sure he's the one that committed the murder. Nobody's ever proven it, but if I had to guess who it was, I'm going to say it was Octavia and her trusty pistol who finally finished her off. So, but
yeah,
that's hard to say.
Yeah. Know? That ending was, I definitely didn't expect any other characters to get introduced for, you know, murder or anything at that point. But you know, you toss the twists out there. But I mean, the wild man and the goat woman, that's just a great.
Yeah. I know. Like, right. And the thing about it is, I think I covered this pretty well in the episode, but the fact that they became nationally known over one, I mean, don't get me wrong, murder is terrible. I feel bad for anyone
who's had
a murder in their family, but it's one murder. Why is it national news? Well, it's national news because they were nuts.
Yeah.
And people needed a distraction. The same way I always talk about when it comes to Bonnie and Clyde and John Dillinger and Pretty Boy Floyd, people needed a distraction in the 30s, man. The Depression had hit this country, and anything people could do for entertainment. It's the reason why newspapers thrived. You could buy a newspaper for a nickel or less. The same reason that people went to the movies. You would think movie theaters would shut down during a depression. Instead, they made more money than ever before because for a few cents, you know, for a dime, you could go to the movies and get a drink and a popcorn and enjoy hours of entertainment. People needed a distraction. So this whole story provided one for them.
Right.
And yeah, it's a, It's a nutty story. It really
it is. And, you know, aside from the famous people you brought up that, you know, descendants and ancestors and things like that, you have stuff about, you know, a minister to Belgium and just like just some of the
generals. I mean, OK, Confederate generals, but whatever. Still, you know, it is down south. So I guess that's a good thing if you live in, you know, Mississippi. But even then, I mean, he still, even after the war, was cashing in on that fact.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, how do you cash in on the fact that you're a Confederate general for Ulysses S. Grant's funeral?
Yeah.
Does that seem like a reach to you? But apparently at the time it was still okay. I mean, it was just, I don't know, maybe people looked at it a different way than we do now. I mean, now we, you know, we don't see it that way, or at least normal people don't, but you know, they don't see that as sedition and traitorous behavior. Back then it was a lost cause.
Sure.
You know, that's the way it had been painted, you know? So I don't know, man. Yeah, there's a lot of people in this that don't belong in a story like this.
And yet
they are. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I just jotted down a couple notes of things I wanted to ask you about or mention. I like how you talked about Glenwood being a town too pretty to burn.
Yeah.
So maybe it's also something about the town, you know?
Well, yeah, it was. Well, and, you know, Grant didn't burn Natchez either. I mean, you know, Vicksburg got it pretty hard because that's where the siege took place. And so they did some damage there, although a lot of the houses survived. But yeah, Natchez, though, really kind of like Savannah, came through unscathed because Grant didn't want to destroy it. There were a lot of people loyal to the Union there. When Sherman made it to Savannah, he didn't destroy it. And so you have a lot of antebellum homes and things that still exist because of that.
Right. Can you talk to me a little bit more? I know you described it, but just more the concept of a new woman.
Well, yeah, the idea there was, and that was something that came about in the latter part of the 1890s. You had women who had kind of turned their back on traditional roles.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, that started, man, I could really go on a tangent here, but that actually started years before. And it was mostly, it was sparked by the spiritualist movement of all things.
Uh-huh, okay.
Because you had this movement that had become really popular in the country and was mostly run by women. Most mediums, spirit mediums, were women. And so they were women who were, you know, at this point in history, they were the property of their husbands. You know, they couldn't do anything without permission from their husband. They couldn't have a bank account. They couldn't have a job. They, you know, had to have children, had to do all this, you know. But spiritualism kind of changed all that because suddenly these women had a way to make an income on their own. So a lot of them did. A lot of them left their husbands, mostly because the spirits told them to. At a time when divorces didn't exist or didn't happen,
right?
The spirit world was telling them, hey, you should probably leave that guy and get a divorce. And they did.
Wow.
Well, who are you going to blame? Well, blame it on the ghosts. Well, obviously, you know that.
Yeah.
So you had a woman who was now starting to, you know, it was also a time when, you know, Susan B. Anthony and you know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and things were starting to push the idea of women voting and things. Now, of course, that wouldn't happen until 1920. But even so, women were becoming much more independent by the end of the 19th century. So the idea of this new woman was something that was really taking off at the end of the 19th century. You know, women, you know, wanted to take a break. They didn't, you know, they went to school. They didn't want to go out and get married. They wanted to work. They wanted to get jobs. Octavia wanted to be a writer. She became a writer, you know, and it was this kind of thing that, and people looked down on that, obviously, the more conservative among them looked down on this idea, but it was something that, you know, we would see coming up and up again and eventually would lead into the suffragist movement and would lead into women voting. And then, you know, after women got the vote, then they got put back in the house again after World War II, after they had been out in the factories taking care of the home front while the guys were at war. Well, the 50s roll along and it's time to get your ass back in the kitchen and make me dinner, you know, kind of thing. And then that wouldn't change again until the 60s and the 70s. But I mean, even so, I mean, women couldn't have bank accounts without their husband's permission until like the 80s.
Yeah.
Couldn't have a credit card. What in the hell? You know, so anyway, so it's, you know, that was the beginning or the early days, at least not the beginning, but at least the early days of, you know, women, you know, finally getting, you know, a sense of their own.
That's okay. That's what I was thinking. Yeah. It was just an earlier wave of women's rights, sort of.
Yeah, you remember when we did the Gone season last time, and we had the Dorothy Arnold, the girl who disappeared in the early, who, you know, had to do all that sneaking around to try and become a writer, you know? But that was at that same time period. She would have been considered a new woman. And, you know, and of course, then the conservative people would say, well, that's what got her killed.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever. You know, we don't even know she died. We just know nobody ever found her. So,
yeah.
But you know what I mean? That's, you know, that's a callback for you.
So. Absolutely. And yeah, you talked about Jenny traveling a lot to be like a social reformer, but also things like running stoplights, stop signs.
Well, yeah. So, and that's another weird thing. You know, she went on and had her own thing going. She, you know, donated money to causes. She got involved in social movements. You know, she was like Jane Addams, you know, in Chicago with the Settlement House. That's what she was doing. And then for whatever reason, gave it up and came back to Natchez. And, you know, I'm going to say that her eccentricities that manifested later maybe kind of got their start, you know, around the time she just decided to come back to Natchez and, you know, kind of shut herself away from civilization, you know, or at least modern life again, because she just sort of got stuck there.
Yeah.
That was one thing people said about her. She continued to wear the same clothes from the 1890s for the rest of her life. You know, the only newfangled thing she had, she didn't have electricity or telephone, but she had that car, which, like you said, would run stoplights with because she just never paid any attention. So it makes you wonder, with all this mental illness, you've got four different people. Well, I don't know. I'm not sure Octavia was really crazy. I think she was clever and dangerous, but I'm not sure she was crazy. The other three, on the other hand, probably had some issues. But, you know, it makes you wonder, everybody was marrying their cousin, you know, for years and years and years. So I don't know. It is down south. So, you know, marrying cousins, I don't know. It became a tradition, apparently. But at least that's how that, you know, idea got started. That stereotype got started.
Right.
They were really doing that.
Real life.
Rich people anyway, you know, because they wanted to preserve the money and the family bloodline. And, well, I don't know. I'm not sure that always works out. Look at some of the royalty over in Europe.
Yeah.
After marrying their cousins and things for years, that didn't go so well.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe that might explain some of the strange behavior.
Yeah. Well, got to keep those bloodlines pure.
Yeah. Right. To keep the family tree all in one line.
Right. So. Well, the way we talk about, you talk about everyone pretty much just getting more reclusive as time goes on and the eccentricities. Gave me like Mrs. Havisham vibes, kind of.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It is. It is kind of like that. I could see that with her, especially with the, you know, the old clothes and everything. And just not a wedding gown.
A wedding cake falling apart stuff. Just, I mean, there's not too much left to talk about. There's the murder, of course. And, you know, Emily and George not getting, I guess, convicted of things because not enough evidence and things.
Yeah. She was convicted at first and she did spend some years in prison, but eventually she was let out. Emily. Was
there you go. I'm sorry.
There really was no evidence against her, but, you know, she was the wrong color at the wrong time.
And
George happened to have a gun that was coincidentally the same caliber as the one that had been used to kill, you know, and then a confession, a so-called confession. I don't know, man. I mean, we've seen that way too many times. And I think that obviously some official felt like she was railroaded or she'd have never gotten out of prison, but she did. I mean, her life was ruined. I mean, Jenny's was over. Duncan's, you know, pretty much ended as well. You know, Dick died not long after, and, you know, only Octavia hung on for a while, of course, because, you know, evil never dies. I don't know, you know.
I definitely expected, at least toward the end, like, oh, okay, Octavia hired them, and then there was a big conspiracy.
I mean, there's no proof of any of it. It's just, and no one really knows. I mean, anybody who's looked into the story has their suspicions, but I really don't think that, I don't really think Dick was bright enough to put, you know, a plan together.
Yeah.
But I do obviously think Octavia was, and she probably figured that she'd get away with it, which
she did.
You know, she never spoke up when anybody else was accused. And why would she?
Of course not.
And her thinking, you know, and I honestly do think that it was her that finally finished her off. Just couldn't take it anymore. Just had enough, you know?
So. Yeah. Oh, man. Well, I mean, that leaves us with the ghost stories. And it's not funny, especially being a musician and stuff, but talking about Dick returning to play the piano, but playing very strangely or missing some certain notes due to his injury.
Well,
you know,
that ghost lost part of his hand, you know, in that accident. Yeah. But yet, you know, played the piano for years, you know, at the castle when people would come, when the tourists started coming, he would provide accompaniment for the tours.
Right.
With bad piano playing, which is not his fault. I'm sure he was good at one time, but you know, when you're missing, you know, that's one thing that as a pianist, you kind of have to have is.
Yes.
And yeah. He was missing a few. So
did they, I wondered, I guess he was still going to school and stuff, but did they not have insurance for hands yet?
Because well,
I don't know, people do that, don't they?
Yeah, probably, but I'm not sure. It was a different time.
I don't think
anybody thought of that kind of thing back then. So
yeah, and then the woods, of course, being haunted by Jenny, I could see that easily. Yeah. You know, and I just sad rich people still hanging around because crazy lives.
Yeah. Well, and you know, our next episode, more rich people, but more recent rich people and in a different area, but also bad. So yeah. Anyway.
Well, those were all the questions and points I really wanted to hit. Is there anything else you wanted to go over specifically with the story's kind of straightforward?
It's a long one. It's not very straightforward. That's the problem. That's why it's long. I did a lot of tangents and, you know, all these family members and how ended up here. So it ended up being a lot longer than I expected. So like I said, hopefully everybody made it all the way through. So anyway, you ready to do the ghostwriter segment then?
Yeah, you know, this is where I would normally say it is now time for our ghostwriter segment. But no one's been emailing me at AmericanKnowledgePodcast@gmail.com.
I think they're texting me instead.
Yeah, hey, I'm fine with that,
I think
too.
People like the short texts, I guess, or it's easier or something. But
emails.
Don't forget that email. It's AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. But you're also welcome to text us anytime, as a lot of you have. But the text number or the haunt line, as we call it, is 217-791-7859. You can send that in. Sometimes you'll get an answer. Other times it might just get read on the show, which is what I'm going to do right now. So anyway, let me read a couple of these off to you. This one comes from our friend Rick Ray, even though his name isn't on it, but I know it's him because I know his wife. And he said, Jane and I visited the American Oddities Museum this past Sunday. Very interesting, but too much to see and read in the time that we had. So solution, we'll see you on June 1st.
Perfect.
Yeah, I guess that worked out all right. So anyway, this one comes to us from Sarah. She's in the 618, but I also know her. It's my friend Michelle's friend. I see her every year at the conference. We'll see her again this year. And
perfect.
I saw her not that long ago, too. And she had a question. She said, a group of friends and myself are going to Savannah, Georgia this summer, and we wanted to do a ghost tour or something while we're there. Do you have any recommendations? Well, in all honesty, I have never taken a ghost tour in Savannah. Usually I avoid ghost tours when I'm on vacation, but occasionally I'll do it anyway, or I'll know somebody. And I did have some friends of mine who I think I've mentioned on here before, the lovely and beautiful Vogel twins, were recently in Savannah, and they posted up on for their podcast. They posted up that they had visited and taken a tour called Savannah Terrors. And they had a good time with it because they got to use ghost equipment, which is not something they normally do.
Oh, it's fun.
I would have loved to have been there for that.
Yeah.
But anyway, they really enjoyed it and had a good time and gave them a recommendation and a shout out. So I will do the same. I will pass that on from the Vogels. So, all right. Well, this one comes to us from the 863. And this one was sent right after our last episode and said, I love the tangents. Remember, we were on a Star Wars.
Yeah, we were.
And she said, especially the Star Wars one on the recent episode, when Troy says, I love Star Wars, but those prequels, Me too, Troy. Me too. So, yeah. So I felt justified on that one. This one comes to us from the 905 and it says, hello. And I'm saying that, and I have to say it in a way, as you'll see, because they're writing from Canada and wanted to know, it's from the 905, want to know if they were the first text from Canada. And I'm pretty sure you are. So anyway, discovered the podcast a couple of years ago when I was looking for a New Orleans fixed. Love the season and went back to listen from the beginning. I'm hoping to one day take a road trip and make it down to the conference. If you're ever in Southern Ontario, check out the city of Hamilton, which has a lot of old mob connections and so many ghosts and haunted locations. Keep being awesome. I had heard that before. I've heard of Hamilton before. I think I heard about it years and years ago. I was still, the first time I lived in Alton, I had heard about Hamilton. There was a website, maybe still around, and they had a tour called Haunted Hamilton Tours. And I wasn't sure where it was, looked it up, and sure enough, Ontario. And when I was a kid, I used to go up there sometimes. We would sometimes stay in Minnesota, and we'd run up into Canada, I don't know why, just to leave the country, I suppose. Back when you could just do that, where it wasn't a big thing. So,
well, thanks for the text, eh?
Yeah. So anyway, this one comes to us from Lisa in the 315. And it says, Troy and Cody, I absolutely adore the two of you. You've got to work on your standards and your podcast. I listen religiously and I never miss an episode. Troy, I love all the history and research that goes into the episodes. I also find the banter between the two of you very funny.
Oh boy,
she really needs to work on herself.
There's a lot of other podcasts.
I know. And really often find myself laughing out loud. Oh, no. Anyway, I wish I lived closer. Would love to attend one of your events. However, Northern New York is a bit far to attend a dinner. LOL. I would agree with that. But hey, keep in mind that, my good friend Amanda Woomer does travel all the way down from upstate New York for the conference every year. So if you don't know about Spook Eats, she's in your area. You should probably just find out what she's doing and go see her.
Totally.
But hey, on the other hand, you never know. Anyway, she says, I look forward to listening to more podcasts.
And oh, thank you.
In Pulaski. And then last one. And this one is from the 509. And it says, it just starts out, ha, ha, ha. This is good. You'll like this.
Okay.
Just got through listening to the May 7th episode. You guys sure made my morning. Not because it was such a great show. I'm saying that. Right. I added that part in. He wrote, I could not stop giggling while listening to y'all try to say Datla Pass. Here's some help. Consider the Y silent. Datlov.
Is that
and
it?
And it says, then adds, this is no help. Then adds, unless I say it wrong, then all bets are off. Let's go with Datlov.
I've heard it so many times.
Oh my God, I cannot say it. I know I watched that movie.
Yeah.
I watched The Devil's Pass, but I haven't seen it in a while. I guess I should have. Well, did we know we'd be talking about that? Why did that even come up?
I can't remember.
Anyway, yeah. So I guess I would have rewatched it or something, or looked for a pronunciation guide, but I think it came up at the last minute. But yeah, I have absolutely no idea what I was talking about when that came up.
That's amazing.
I know the story. Oh, no. You know what? Somebody asked about it on one of the texts.
Is that what it was?
Yeah. And I said, no, I wasn't going to write about it because it's in Russian. I'm never going there. That's why.
I think
so. We didn't know how to pronounce it. And it was really bad.
Something that I think I just want to remind people of is we record this and, we edit how we need to put it out there. And then that's pretty much it. So people can keep listening over and over and over again. But this is in our heads real quick and then out. And we just kind of forget. Yeah. So I didn't even think to look up how to pronounce that for this episode.
Me either.
I didn't remember. We talk about it.
I didn't either until I just saw that text.
Yeah. So we're not.
I didn't recall.
So. We're not intentionally trying to remain ignorant. It's just we just are.
Yeah. It's not an intentional thing. We're not trying. It's kind of like, what is it Yoda says? Don't try.
We do or do not. There's no try.
Yeah. Oh well, whatever it is. See, I mean that's not even a prequel, and I still don't remember it. All right, let's be done. Just remember that if you want to make fun of us or whatever, You know, text us on the hotline, 217-791-7859. So anyway, let's wrap it up. Thanks for listening, guys. Share the show with your friends, neighbors, anybody you know. If you like the show, or even if you don't like it, leave us a 5-star review on iTunes anyway. Because, well, if you don't like it and you leave a review, it's still going to help us. So,
yeah.
But hopefully you do. We do try hard. Well, we don't try to learn how to pronounce things, but we do try hard to give you a good show. So anyway, you could check us out on our social media. You can find Cody and I on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, or whatever the hell it's called now. Don't forget, though, also one last thing, make sure you use the discount code podcast when you're shopping for books or tours or events or anything else at AmericanHauntings.net or on Cody's shirt store, which you can find linked from there. Or you can just go to AmericanHauntingsClothing.com and you can use that code there too and get 10% off. And so, yeah. Over to you.
Yeah, Troy. The last thing I was just thinking is maybe you and I need to hit up rosettastone.com/today and learn some new languages.
Yeah. Or, well, maybe we should just try their English program.
Exactly.
Maybe that would help.
Honestly, yeah, we'll start there.
A foreign language.
Well, this episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written and performed by Troy Taylor, and it was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. To find out more about the show, check out our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com, which features show notes, links, photographs that go along with each episode. Thanks again for listening.
Yeah, we have a big grade about that. I mean, it was one thing when it was missing people.
Yeah.
So I didn't do it on this one.
Yeah.
Maybe we should just take that part out, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. There's pictures on there. Hey, well, you know what? Somebody might be listening to an old episode or something.
Sure. Yeah.
Of course, they're not going to hear this. Well, anyway, yeah, we'll work on it. We're working on it. I'm just a little free time. That's all I need. So
yeah, exactly. Just a little free time. That's what we need. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See you later.
See you later.
Oh, boy. That was fun.
That was fun.
We had some nice, fun little banter there.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.